הגליגי. נצ'י נצ'.
יאה.
הקפה שחור חזק.
All right, folks, shalom and welcome to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live on the Land of Israel Network, usually from the Land of Israel from Jerusalem, but alas, I am on the road, friends, I am on the road, and you know that wherever I go, I search out the Land of Israel and its energies and its feelings and sparks that it sends out across the world, and I am now in a very beautiful part of the United States of America, Del Mar, California, where the mosquito, the Penasquitos Lagoon River empties into the Pacific. It's a river of life here. You can just see it. Fish are jumping out of it. There's all kinds of birds above. It's a beautiful place. And it's September the 12th. That means that it's one day after September 11th. And yesterday I was in beautiful Coronado Island, here next to San Diego, or part of San Diego, I don't know exactly, and I'm zooming around, finding the Chabad Synagogue, connecting to different things, I'm meeting people that want to take part in the story of Israel. And I hear that there's a concert on in the background because it was September 11th, and I recalled that day, September 11th, when I was actually living in Manhattan, Upper Manhattan, 189th Street, and it was my good buddy Alex Treyman who called me up at, I think it was 9:10, 9:11 in the morning. And he said, Yishai. I said, yes, Alex, why are you calling me at those days? That was considered early. He said to me, you better turn on your TV now. I turned on the TV, and a few minutes after watching what was going on, we went up to the roof of the building. And we looked down Amsterdam Avenue, more than 100 streets down, and we could see smoke billowing from the place where the Twin Towers stood. And I recall how intense those days were, not just that day, but the following days. It just actually got more and more intense. A tremendous, I don't like the word tragedy exactly, a crime took place, a heinous mass murder took place. And I remember that the city was shut down, and we felt as though we were trapped on a dangerous island. And there was really a sense that anything could happen. And there was a lot of kindness between people, and there was also a sense of wildness at the same time, which was like one of those kind of apocalyptic movies. It was a type of apocalyptic moment that had struck New York City, one of the capitals of the world, and we were on it. In the subsequent days, things kept going for a while. You have to know that the smoldering itself took place for a month. There was still smoke and a smell of burning metal all the way coming from downtown. And I remember that Malka and I, Malka at the time, we were seeing each other, we were just friends, I guess, or we were friendly. And anyway, she was later to become my fiance, and we were to get married. We went all the way downtown as far as we could with sandwiches, just to help first responders. We handed them out. And then we sat at a bar and nobody even looked at us. It was such a wild scene down there. This was the bar that was the most downtown, the closest to Ground Zero. And just there was a wild feeling in the air. Of course, there was a lot of grieving to be done. We saw lines of people standing next to churches. We saw people with posters saying, have you seen this and this person? There was a lack of knowledge and a lack of clarity, and there was a lot of pain, and there was a sense of danger, and it was really, on top of being a physical experience, it was also very much a mental experience. And here in Del Mar, I'm in the offices of Dr. Ken Druck. Dr. Ken Druck, I was just looking at his office, and he is a man who, here on September the 12th, I am looking at wreckage. He has been given by the authorities a metal piece of the Twin Towers, ashes from Ground Zero, maybe ashes of people, and a flag of the United States given to him by the fire department of New York City. And the reason they've given it to him is not because he's a good fireman, nor is it because he's a good police officers. He's not. He's not a police officer. He is a psychologist, a person who had already a budding successful psychology practice, and he had written books. But then personal tragedy struck him, and he became an expert in dealing with tragedy and helping people cope, and not only cope, but actually thrive with the pain that they endured. And that, of course, those things that he has in his office are testament to that. Dr. Kendrick, thank you so much for being on the show today. As I'm traveling here in the United States, I'm looking for I'm looking for many things, and then suddenly I heard about you, and I wanted to pop in and do a little radio with you about your experiences. So why is it that the fire department and the New York City Police Department have given you mementos from September 11th? What did you have to do with that?
First of all, Yishai, thank you so much. It's so good to have you here with us, and I consider it to be an honor and a privilege to be able to speak to my family in Israel through you and through your wonderful work. The reason why, as you come into my office, you see pictures, you see things framed, you see commemorative gifts and ways, statements of acknowledgement and gratitude from the mayor of New York and from the New York Fire Department is because I received a call, as had happened for many years. My phone rings, and it's somebody on the other end saying, "We need your help." And this time it was the mayor's office of New York saying, "We have over 3,000 people who have perished and or died in a plane crash, and their families, and it's an overwhelming situation, and we need your help." And so I started what ended up being a regular commute to New York from California to help coordinate and set up bereavement support groups, centers, programs for children who had lost their mothers and fathers, programs for families that we call Take the High Road, because the average age of the person who died in 9/11 was 38. So you had a living mother and father, you had a wife, you had small children in many cases, and families needed to learn what it meant to honor the person they had lost and the way they treated one another, to take the high road rather than what too often happens, which is families tearing apart at the point of tragedy. So I came into New York, and I was asked to walk on stage at the first town hall meetings, 1,000 people in the room, and stand up before those people and try to begin, people who had no skin on, and try to begin to help them make sense. When the life that your life has ended as you know it, you are walking around, the medical equivalent would be that you would be in the ICU with tubes in and out of you. But when we're grieving, there are no tubes to be seen. You're walking around with defenseless. You have been stripped. Your life as you know it has ended. You are standing in the ashes of Plan A, and Plan B doesn't look so hot. It looks like you're going to be in agony and pain for the rest of your life.
Or you never really had a Plan B.
Yeah.
You certainly weren't expecting to, when you sent off your husband or wife in the morning, you didn't expect them to not come back.
Exactly. And that's something that our family had experienced directly with the death of my oldest daughter. So I had, over the years, been called into service by individuals, organizations, and now cities, communities that were in distress. And this is what I did for 4.5 years, and we started support groups out here because many of the families who had lost loved ones, as you know, one of the planes was headed towards California, so many of the families were out here as well. So that's the work that I did, and that's the honoring that I performed for many years.
All right. So the way you got to this is you were already in psychology, but then you had to deal with your own psychological trauma, and you had to learn the issue of bereavement, grieving, and maybe you can distinguish these words for us. Judaism certainly has a very worked out system of bereavement. In fact, my Gentile friends often tell me, we're jealous of you. And I say, which one? You know, which thing are you jealous of? And they say, we're jealous of your bereavement process. My father passed away, and I don't know, you know, what to do with it. I don't know how to do it. Judaism has a process that is 7 days, 30 days, and then 1 year, and this whole thing that you have to do in order to kind of get back into the community. First, you have kind of no commandments until you bury the body. You're like totally out of commandments. And then you have to sit 7 days, and everybody's got to come and like feed you. And then the first 3 days of those 7 days, people aren't supposed to ask you questions, and you could just talk. And then the next 4 days, they ask you questions. And then on the 30th day, this and this process of Kaddish, certainly of saying things. So Judaism has a long storied system of dealing with the tragedy. And maybe also just the cycle of life. Maybe the word tragedy is a little bit too strong. Death is a part of life, right? But usually we'd like to think that children bury parents. But what happened in your case, as in case of many others, sadly, you had to bury your daughter. And that's where you kind of changed your career. Tell me a little bit about the story about you burying your daughter.
Well, first,
and I'm sorry, of course, to pry in such a... you know, it's almost embarrassed to talk about it such a way, but that it is.
Well, we're not. You and I are sitting here and talking as brothers, as fathers, perhaps as people who are trying to touch the hearts of so many people, because everybody listening has suffered some kind of a loss. Everybody has had their heart torn out. Even if you didn't know somebody, you were near the epicenter of a tragedy, of something unspeakable, and you have had to somehow reprogram your brain and nervous system to be able to deal with this and to transform the tragedy and the adversity, whatever adversity you've had to face, into becoming the better version of yourself. That's the challenge of grief.
That's interesting. Right there, you're making a big leap. You're saying that instead of just dealing with my problem and somehow going on, I actually have to take the high road. I have to somehow change, and not only just change to deal with it, but actually better myself through the process of bereavement. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, the opportunity is there. Mm-hmm. There's no have to, but and some people spend the rest of their lives staring into the abyss and basically making their pain the central organizing principle of life.
Right.
I encourage people to make their love for the one they've lost or the ones they've lost the central organizing principle of their life. Mm-hmm. To make their life and to make my life an expression of my love meant that I had to honor my daughter's life and spirit. And we even developed a code of the five honorings, which I'm glad to share with you. But when Jenna died, there's no way to describe the pain of a father who's the most important thing in my life and the greatest source of greatest joy has been my two daughters. So for
I saw a picture of them, beautiful young ladies. One is alive and well. You call it your earthly daughter?
My earth daughter and my angel daughter. They're both, interestingly, they're both alive and well. Mm-hmm. My angel daughter, I wear a necklace with the word Hineni around it, and symbolizing the fact that paradoxically my daughter may be gone, but she is right here. Here I am. I am here. I am the presence of spirit. So we're asked and we're challenged to find paradoxical meanings in the passing and the tragic loss of loved ones, that in some way they are absolutely gone. They're not going to write. They're not going to call, as the life that we had with them is gone forever. But they are also present, intimately present. And there's not a day in my life that goes by without me telling my daughter how much I love her, both daughters. And without.
But is that a source of pain? We're talking about the angel daughter. Is that a source of pain, or is that a source of some kind of life affirmation?
The challenge of loss, and especially sudden loss, is to, in the beginning, it's all pain. Everything is associated, everything is a trigger, everything is a source of pain. And over time and processing our grief. And I can't emphasize enough the importance of what it means to process our grief, not to become the dumbed down version, not to deceive ourselves, not to hide, deny, and repress our pain or our anger, but to find constructive channels for expressing those things and doing it in a code of honor. For example, one of the ways, and talk about what's built into Jewish tradition, one of the ways that we honor those we love who we've lost is to do good things in their name. Another ritual, by the way, I'll tell you, just to back up a little bit, you said, Ken, here you were, and you got the phone call that your daughter had been killed in India while studying abroad. Well, I was on the phone within a couple of hours with President Clinton, who was the president at that time, and he and his wife did everything in their power and were successful in telling the Indian government, which is highly bureaucratic and wanted to take all kinds of time to investigate and go through, that this was a Jewish family and that there needed to be a burial immediately and that they had to expedite everything in such a way as to get my daughter's body back to the U.S. where she could be buried properly in accord with her faith. And that happened.
Let's just back up for a second. That's an amazing story. But your daughter was on a semester at sea voyage. She was in India. And you see your child flourish and going to India, seeing the world.
Your kid comes up and says, Dad, there's this amazing trip. Come on. You know,
I remember seeing the voyage at sea's semester at sea. Things being like, this is the coolest thing.
It's the coolest thing. We live on a ship and we're going to go through South America and Africa. She went through Africa. She met Mandela. We're going to go on safari in Kenya. We'll go up to India. We'll see the Taj Mahal, the greatest symbol. And the night before she died, she calls home. And of course, I'm recording all of her phone calls home. I want her to hear the richness in her voice. I want her to hear her own stories firsthand. So I'm recording the call and she said, Dad, I can't believe it. Tomorrow we're going to go visit the Taj Mahal, the greatest symbol of eternal love, perhaps, in all of the world. And we're going to see the Taj Mahal. And we got up and we watched the sunrise over the Ganges, where all the wise and great people go to where there's birth, where there's death, the full cycle of life. And she was even writing in her journal at the time of her death. And so there's no way to describe the experience that people go through. I said before, it's like being walking around without any skin, being on life support. But at some point, we are in choiceless pain and agony in the beginning. But at some point, our journey becomes choiceful. At some point, we stand at a crossroads and we look down both roads, and one is a pain where one is a path that we make pain the central organizing principle, and the other is a path where we make love and honor. And I have to admit, there are days I wandered down that path of pain where it was choiceless, where I was in agony, where I wanted to spit in the face of the universe, and I needed to find constructive ways of doing that. I was angry with God. I made attributions to God. I made God the puppeteer that was watching over everything. And I was crying out and wailing, how could you let this happen? As though there was an attribution that I constructed, that God was the puppeteer. God wasn't the force of good and love in the world. God was to be watching over. And it was only, you know, after I could see a tear in the eye of God and could feel that, and that God was crying with me, that I was able to deepen my faith and move through that and progress in this code of honor. And I started telling you what the honor is. First one, of course, is do good things in their name.
Okay. Seeing a tear in the eye of God, I actually think I know very much what you're saying, and that's a very, very deep concept, because oftentimes those who believe in God, when they suffer, when the Jewish people have suffered, continue to suffer unspeakable trauma and tragedy, sometimes there's this an attribution to God that, hey, you're being cold to my pain. You're like, now the Psalms say a few times that God, it is bitter for God, the death of his loved ones. Where, how did you see, instead of this cold, invisible, God that you know, he's not coming to your Shiva, seemingly, ostensibly. How did you attribute to him now this tear when he heard about your daughter's death?
It was in the allowing myself to be angry, to wail, to express, to grieve, to cry out in impotent rage, and in allowing myself that expression, rather than shushing myself, quieting myself, crossing my hands and legs and being a good griever, which sometimes we feel we don't want to anger God. We don't want to be disloyal. My God, we don't want to lose God. So sometimes we edit ourselves, we dumb ourselves down without realizing that part of our responsibility as those who have suffered is to find constructive outlets, to cry out, to give ourselves safe refuge, to cry out rather than to hide, deny, repress, and hold it in as though we have to be strong. And
fine. Yeah. So that's very Jewish. That's Abrahamic. You kind of turn the finger back at God and you say, hey, you know, and you can express yourself. And in a sense, Judaism allows for that. It allows for that dialogue with God. Many other religions don't have that. They don't have that sense that the person actually can talk back to God and have a relationship. And there's much discourse there that yes, we could pray to him, change his mind, argue with him. The quintessential Abrahamic story is the one where he's arguing with God, and he's like, and it's a bewildering story, and that's one of the foundational stories of Judaism. But I asked you about, how did you see the tear in God's eyes? How did you see that he felt your pain and that he was sad, shall we say, about your pain? That he was discomforted by your pain, and that he was out there comforting you in your pain.
It's often said that the most powerful experience we can have is the feeling of being understood, of being met. Go back to Martin Buber, meeting. That, and in allowing me the safety and the refuge and the permission and the allowing of my anger and my impotent rage, there was a feeling, and it was nothing I had to do. It was organic, that when we feel deeply understood by another person, by God, when we look across into the eyes of another person and we see that they get it, they're not making noise in their head waiting for a response. They're listening intently with their hearts. There's a deep empathy and compassion. I felt that compassion on the deepest level possible from my God. And it was in that compassion, and that tear that I could imagine in the eye of God, because I when I said I saw it with my heart's eyes. But that imagining was one of the most powerful images I have ever had in my life. And it allowed me to know that I was not alone. It allowed me to know God on a deeper level, instead of the very almost childish image that I have possessed of God as the puppeteer and the attributions that I've made to God on that basis. I had a deeper understanding of God as the force of love, goodness, and compassion.
I think also there's a giant maturity in that. You were saying it was an immature image to also, I don't know, I find that it's very empathetic, what you're saying. It's empathetic towards God. We're always asking him to have empathy for us, but to have a little bit of empathy for him and to see that he has empathy for us, there's a tremendous maturity there. Okay. Your daughter gets killed in a auto accident, right? in the end, it's an
automobile. Bus accident. She's on a bus with 27 kids on the most treacherous road in the world where 1,600 people die. 2 minutes before the accident, one of the kids stands up and says, "Tell this guy to slow down. He's going to kill all of us." And 2 minutes later,
a kid stood up on the bus. Stood up, meaning to say he's not taking it anymore. A lot of times you're in 27 people, you're going to be quiet. Everybody else is sucking it up, and you're just going to. Some kid is like, "There's a danger here," and he gets up and he makes a public proclamation.
Right, and my daughter, seeing a young woman crying on the back of the bus, goes back to comfort her. And both of them die. Both of them are dead, laying in the road, photographed by the Indian newspaper on the front page the next day. And my phone rings. And as I said before, my life as I knew it ends. And I'm standing in the middle of something. I don't recognize this person in the mirror as myself.
You're a psychologist. You're ready.
I'm a psychologist, but you know what? It was useless, if not harmful, to be a psychologist. There's probably so little that I ever learned or ever experienced that could prepare me for the grief journey that I was to begin and prepare me to assist other people as well.
And I want to ask you just a parenthetical question here. And I'm going to ask you a follow-up question about this afterwards, but you sent your kid on a semester at sea, and she's traveling through India. There must have been some sense in you a little bit, just because the mind will do that. Some guilt. Why did I send her to this thing? And I know that you know the mind plays these kind of tricks on us, because the truth is that a person can get killed crossing the street, or just you know, a heart attack or an aneurysm, and you know, sometimes your number gets called, but. But how do you deal with those, you know, residual, unnecessary thoughts that want to punish you for doing X, Y, or Z?
Isha, you're very insightful, and you're pointing out something that is so critically important. As a matter of fact, it's the core of step one of working with families who've gone through this, because 90% of us will implicate ourselves in the death of our children or our loved one. We will find irrational in the process of trying to connect the dots and somehow undo what can't be undone. Mm. We will connect the dots irrationally and tell ourselves a story, a magical story in which we could have interceded. We should have interceded. It's what we didn't do. It's what we did do. And we put ourselves in what I call the torture chamber of guilt.
Torture chamber of guilt.
It has no redemption. It's a one-way street to hell. It has absolutely no redeeming, healing, or restorative justice value to do it. But we do it because it's part of our attempt to undo what has been done. We implicate ourselves. It's like being in a courtroom with only a prosecuting attorney waving the admonishing finger of blame in our face, pointing to us and saying, "You're guilty."
But this is all in order to somehow psychologically undo it.
It's the psychologically... Mm-hmm. Undo, because we have to find somebody guilty. We have to make sense of the senseless.
So it's either God is guilty or I'm guilty.
Yep. And we do it. And we almost do it universally.
Right.
And I remember for 1 year, you could not have disarmed me from the razor sharp accusation of myself as I sent my daughter to her death. What was I thinking? Sending her to a third world country. I didn't know they were going to rebook a flight. The flight was overbooked. They were going to stick these kids on a bus. I sent my daughter to her death. And it took a woman in one of the support groups when I started the Jenna Druck Center to honor my daughter.
That's your daughter's name, Jenna.
Jenna.
Angel daughter, you call her now.
And when I started the center to help other families, it took a woman sitting in one of our support groups to say, "Dr. Druck, with all due respect, I sent my daughter to the store 2 blocks away from our home to get milk. And I didn't know there'd be two people street racing in front of the store. You didn't have to send your daughter to India to die. So the randomness, you know, we begin and only we can. We try to disarm people of guilt.
So Dr. Druck, a psychologist, needed somebody in a support group that he founded.
To tell you. To be my teacher.
Right.
And, you know, that teaching process has continued for the last 20 years. I have learned so much more than I've taught, I'm sure, from the families, whether it's in Newtown, Connecticut, where 20 children were murdered, whether it's the 9/11 families, many of whom I've spoken to in the last few days, whether it's Columbine, where the school shooting, whether it's Hurricane Katrina, whether it's other parts of the world where I've helped out,
like
there have been tragedies.
Like Korea, the Jewish state as well.
The Jewish state as well. And many years ago, I got a visit. This is after 5 years of running the Jenna Druck Center, and we started winning awards and getting recognitions and getting publicity, and I was asked to go on CNN very often. And I get a call from a bereaved Israeli father who has just started an organization called the Parents Circle. Yitzhak Frankenthal called me and said, I'm going to be, me and my Palestinian counterpart, Ghazi, are going to be in San Diego, and I was told that I should contact you. I spoke with Yitzhak. I found out about his son, who had been kidnapped and murdered by Hamas, and I invited him to the stage. I said, please let me put on a community event, because you and this Palestinian father are going to be our teachers. We are so remotely and cluelessly removed from the reality in Israel and from possible solutions to forging peace that we in San Diego, you need to be our teachers. And I invited him and Ghazi, and we put on an event in San Diego. And I learned all about the Parent Circle, an organization that says where the parents decide that the way to honor their loved one is not through what we call the false promise of revenge, but through saving one family from having to endure the agony, the lifelong choiceless agony of having lost a loved one to violence, that they honor their children by forging peace, by being a voice for peace, and exploring the possibilities that if we're in dialogue with each other, if we stop objectifying one another, if we humanize ourselves to one another, there may be an avenue to peace. And most of them know it's not going to be that simple. Right. It's not that right. simple. And some of the emotions are so deeply embedded that it's going to take heroic work over generations. But I was fascinated with this because I also received many calls from families whose children have been murdered.
Right. So let me pause you for a second. First thing, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, Land of Israel Network, landofisrael.com. Check out all our other great shows. And this is Yishai. I'm on the road. You guys know that from time to time we do shows on the road. And I'm in beautiful Del Mar, California right now. With Dr. Ken Druck, and I want you to check out, Ken Druck is just easy, at Ken Druck is on Twitter, K-E-N-D-R-U-C-K, and, you know, KenDruck.com, if you just Ken Druck, you'll find him so easily, and we're talking about dealing with pain. Dr. Ken Druck has lost his daughter, yet has regained her as an angel daughter. In the sense that he lives with her every day, and in a sense, not just lives with her, has enlivened her. And we'll talk about that in a second. Dr. Ken, you lost your daughter in a bus accident in a faraway country. We talked about the, what did you call it, torture chamber of guilt.
Yes.
Which strangely reminds me of I don't want to make too much of a joke out of it, but I'm married to a delightful, incredible woman who I love so much. Her name is Malka, and she comes from the Hungarian world. And the torture, it just makes me laugh. I just don't want to hurt her feelings, but guilt is a big part of that culture. It's a humongous part of that culture. They feel guilty when they feel too good. They find ways to spice guilt into so much. And I'm always laughing at her that I tell her that the real spices of Hungarian culture is either paprika or guilt. You started now dealing with the issue of losing your children to violence. I want to ask you a question. Your daughter died in an accident, but an accident that could have been prevented had the driver driven
negligence.
It was negligence, gross negligence.
But it was not at the hand of another.
Right, it was not at the hand of another. Then there are many people like my good friend Leah Goldman, who I miss so much in my life, who died to pancreatic cancer. This thing came. It attacked her. Generally, people don't survive for more than a year. And that was her case as well. And she shrank. This beautiful woman shrank and was, you know, fed in different ways. And it just attacked her. And there was nobody to blame. There was no negligence. There was a disease. But you turn your accusatory prosecutor towards God and you say, why? Or towards... You know, or
cancer.
What is that thing? What is this thing? But there's a different thing that happens when somebody with intent, okay, comes and kills your child in order to kill your child with malice intent from the get-go. And I want to remind our listeners that I work for the Jewish community of Hebron. That's the tombs of the founding fathers and mothers of the Jewish people. And it's a Jewish community surrounded by an Arab community, some of which, and even much of which, today has succumbed to the ideology of jihad. And only 3 months ago was I at a funeral of a little girl, 12-year-old girl, who was not killed. It wasn't a tragedy. She was murdered with full vehemence and murder. By a young jihadist, 17-year-old, who jumped the wall, came into her bedroom and stabbed her violently, flipped her body over, stabbed her some more. Her name was Halel Yafa Ariel. And it was not only that, when the rapid response team came into the house, including the father, the terrorist was lurking around the house, and it ended up that one of the rapid responders, there was firing, and one of the rapid responders lost an eye. It was lucky to survive. So there was a whole ton of violence. When I was interviewed as the spokesman of the nearby community of Hebron, I told the press something surprising. I said, this young man who committed this murder is certainly going to hell. He did an awful, awful, awful crime, and he set out to murder a little girl and did so in horrific fashion. However, you'd be surprised to learn that I believe that he too is a victim. He was a victim of propaganda that taught him from age zero to hate Jews, to want to murder Jews, to think that he's going to heaven for murdering Jews. And so there's a part of me that even has a little bit of, I don't want to misuse a word here, I don't know, empathy, but like I understand that he's a victim of child abuse, that he's been brainwashed into this. In any case, I have been following the Ariel family throughout this whole period, connecting them to different people, and maybe I will try to connect them to you as well, Dr. Ken Druck. But is there a difference between how we deal with cancer, this God, this force of nature, what happened to you, your daughter, Jenna, negligence, and overt murder? There must be different feelings involved with that. And you talked about, you know, the false promise of revenge, but there's an anger. There was a bludgeon force against you, and you, what do you do with that? How do you where's the crush zone there? How do you brace emotionally with that impact? Where does the force return? What do you do with that?
You're describing a condition that I don't even know if I can imagine what it would be like to be in the mind and body and spirit of a father whose daughter has been murdered, who has died at the hand, the violent, savage hand of a a murderer whose intent it was to snuff out my daughter's life. So that's the first thing I want to say. I can't even imagine, I can't even go there. And the challenge, and I think it's an important thing to be able to say, because the challenge of somehow creating a new normal, of somehow fighting our way back into life, of even imagining, as you've pointed out, that that was a human being who was so brainwashed, who has been relegated to subhuman status to the point of being indifferent to the value of a human life, that until we get to the ability to empathize at that level, I'm not saying we fall in love with and send that kid to college or look for some restorative justice scenario. I'm saying until we understand the mentality and how that kind of indifference to life and hatred and behavior and violence, the degree of that violence, until we understand the origins of that, how that could possibly originate in a human being, then we're not going to get to the core of the problem. We're not going to know, because if we are depending upon revenge, I talked before about the false promise of revenge. If we think that killing his father or his sister or his brother, or when he gets older, his son or daughter, is going to solve the problem and stop the bleeding, we're fooling ourselves. So how do we both protect ourselves? How do we deepen our level of understanding of where this level of savagery and hatred is born and how it's born? And also, how do we honor and respect those who are family members of the fallen? How do we respect the fact that their journey is so challenging and complicated that it's almost beyond our imagination?
Right, that's where I'm at. I'm there's geopolitics and there's the fight. Okay, let me leave that aside. I've got to deal with these people, and I mean that not like I've. It's an honor for me to try to help them, but like, how would you counsel that family to move it along? And maybe
let's go back to the five honorings.
Here's the five. Here's the moment.
The first honoring is our own survival. That the way we honor, the way this beautiful family that I one day hope to meet, I'd be honored to meet, and I'd be honored to help and learn from, is to attend to their own survival. That means practicing a level of self-care that perhaps they've never had to practice before. Because, as I said before, the medical equivalent of what they've gone through would have them in the hospital with tubes running in and out, and the line between their own life and death is very thin. So self-care and survival is the first honoring, that you fight your way back into life, you live to fight another day, and you hold in faith the possibility that your pain that is choiceless at this moment will not always be so, that you will be able to refocus, that life will come back into you, and you will be able to refocus, and this is a second honoring.
So the first honoring is like, stay healthy, stay alive.
Take care of yourself.
Economically, physically.
People who are...
Eat well, that type of thing?
It's not only eat well, it's keep people who are energy suckers. Some people drain us of energy.
Right.
Some people are energy givers,
right,
and some people are energy takers. Right. When you're grieving and you're in acute grief, you don't have the luxury of taking care of other people. You need to take care of yourself and be taken care of. So the first thing, and I have something called the do's and don'ts of grief support. And if somebody goes onto my website or onto my Facebook page or contacts me, I'm glad to send you this list.
All right, this is very important, folks.
The do's and don'ts of grief support. You give it to your coworkers, you give it to your friends, you give it to Mishpucha, you give it to the neighbors, and it will tell them in a second, here are 10 things you can do to be a burden on those you're wishing to support, or here are 10 things you can do to honor and support in the highest sense of what support means. And many of this coincides with Jewish tradition, so some of it won't surprise you at all. But that's the first thing.
Okay, so the first thing is take care of yourself.
Survive.
Like, honor the dead by not joining them.
By not succumbing.
Right, not succumbing there. Okay, that makes perfect sense to me.
Second honoring is to embody some precious, irreplaceable aspect of their essence. Some aspect. So if it was my daughter's kindness, that it is now mine to embody. Mm-hmm. I'm going to allow my daughter to be my teacher of kindness, mm-hmm. or of tenacity, or of fierce determination, or of lightheartedness. Whatever the essential quality, the eternal essential quality that our loved one possessed is now ours to embody, that we become that when we grow up, as we become, and that becomes the better version of us. So embody their essence. The third thing is to do something good in their name. For me, that meant starting the Jenna Druck Center. It meant taking the leadership program for girls that my daughter started at age 15. My daughter was a natural-born leader who was voted to be one of America's future leaders. I had senators telling me that they thought she was going to be the first woman president. So doing something good in her name meant carrying on her work.
Right. It's in her name, but in a sense, it's her doing it. Take that what that person's mission is, and the person's not dead. Let that person keep going. Keep doing their thing.
And it doesn't have to be complicated. You know, it could be that your child fed the homeless. It could be that your child every year lit a candle. Right. In my case, my daughter said, "Dad, if this is the best we can do in teaching girls how to be, through their teen years, to teach them how to be women, then we suck," is what she said. She said, "If this is the best we can do, we suck.
Right.
And she said, "I want to do something to teach girls how to use their teenage years as a gift, to find out how they are beautiful, what their gifts are, and to develop those gifts and put boys on the side, put them on the sideline, develop your own sense of your own beauty, your own magnificence, your own power, your own strength, your own spirit." And so when she died, the Jenna Druck Center started a program, and to date, we've had over 18,000 girls go through that program.
Wow.
A leadership program to become leaders in their own lives, in their communities, and the world.
Okay, so Jenna, in death or in angelic life, continues to do her mission, maybe even, in a sense, quite successful. By the way,
We call her the CAO, by the way, the Chief Angelic Officer.
Very good. I was talking to mutual friends of ours, and I said to them, look at the Lubavitcher Rebbe, for example. Is he dead? Far from it. He's incredibly alive. His efforts are everywhere. So far, we have survive. Survive, don't succumb. Second thing, embody a certain aspect, an attitudinal aspect or a characteristic trait or a favorite thing, and let the angelic version of the person that is not with us be the teacher of that. And the third one is do something in their name, but not even in their name. Let them continue to do their thing. Let them continue their efforts. Okay.
And I'm excited
to hear four and five here.
The second half of number three is I could hear Jenna saying, "Dad, use everything you know and everything you're going to learn to help other families who have to go through this hell." That was the other part of the Jenna Druck Center is called Families Helping Families. So it was a dual mission, girls' leadership and families helping families.
Is that its own category of things because like a lot of people who suffer cancer loss, they want to help they want to help the study of cancer or whatever it is. So is that its own category or
yes.
would you say?
It's part of the same category. Mm-hmm. For me take my trip to the bottom of pain,
right,
which taught me a compassion at a level that many people never get to experience, to use that compassion and to use what I wish I didn't know, but that I do know, to help other families that have to go through this.
Very good.
Number four.
Yep.
Number four is to begin to write new chapters of life. It would pain me in the beginning to think that a new song would come out. My daughter was never going to hear that song.
Right.
That a new restaurant would open. Something would happen in the world that she wasn't here to experience. It's almost like I wouldn't allow life to go on, including my own life.
So this family that I'm talking about, the Ariel family in Kiryat Arba next to Hebron, they're very much still very much how did you call it?
Well, it's a grief coma and choiceless pain.
Choiceless pain. I think they're very much there still.
Which is okay, which is not only okay,
right,
which is healthy.
Right.
Too often we pathologize grief and we want to rush people. We want to put a spin on it.
Right.
We want them, how are you doing? We ask them all the wrong questions.
Right.
Instead of understanding that grief occurs outside of time in some ways, and that people need the time and the healing that they need, that grief has a life and a timetable all of its own, and each of us is different. So that kind of respect and honor and support is needed.
So the reason I ask you this is because I noticed that Mrs. Ariel, Rina Ariel, she sent out some kind of message saying, well, Hallel is never going to go to third grade. I see that she goes to the store, she sees the new backpacks and the new pencil cases are being sold, and it's like, you know, my little girl was supposed to do that, but she's never going to do that.
These chapters will never be written, and I cannot go on.
Right.
What am I? I'm supposed to go out for dinner and have a good time tonight.
Right.
My daughter's dead.
Right.
And I'm la-di-da. I'm going to go on and
she can't go to this dinner.
That's right. So there's a phase that families, mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters will go through, where we deny ourselves any remote kind of pleasure, any advancement, the ability to write new chapters in our lives. And yet that is part of the honoring, that we have to have the courage and the faith to begin writing new chapters and to include them in whatever way feels meaningful. You know, I do something new or something exciting, I'm writing a new book now, I'll tell my daughter about it. I'll ask her if she has any ideas.
Now, your daughter, she's virtually in an angelic, she's not virtual, she's real, in an angelic,
yes,
in the cloud, in the sense, right?
Yes.
I'm just trying to use a modern term. But she's also buried not so far away from where you live.
That's right.
Does that give you a lot of nachat, as we say in Hebrew, a lot of consolation? Do you find that going to the tomb or to the grave, does that give you something more?
When I go to her grave, she chases me out. Dad, what are you doing here?
Hmm.
You don't think you're going to be with me long enough?
Hmm.
I'm going to be buried right next to her.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, Dad, go out, get into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Write new chapters in life and tell me all about it. Do good things with every day. Make every day of the rest of your life an expression of your love for me, for my sister, for our family, for our people, for the world. Give the gift of your life. Go out and do that. And trust me, Dad, you'll be with me for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So I get chased out of the cemetery, mm-hmm, whenever I go. Mm-hmm. I hear the same thing. And sometimes I say, forget it, I'm going to lay down in the grass with you. I just want to be with you. She had a saying as a little girl. She'd say, Daddy, be with.
Be with.
And in other words, put down the newspaper, put the cell phone down, no distractions. She knew she had an ADD parent,
mm-hmm,
a distractible parent. Daddy, just be with.
Be with.
And the be with was to be present.
Mm-hmm.
Be present with our children.
And maybe parenthetically, there is a lesson there, not about how to deal with death, but how to deal with life.
Yes.
Which is, folks, things happen in this crazy world. And be with. Be with while you can. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but don't learn the lesson the hard way. Like,
that's right.
Life is fleeting, and even the idea of living every day as the last day is a Jewish idea.
That's right. Steffi, my earth daughter, when Jenna made her last phone call home. It was in the middle of the night. I was like, Jenna, it's the middle of the night here. What are you calling? Steffi, I just had the most amazing time. Jenna, we'll talk about it later. I'm tired. I've got to go to school tomorrow morning.
Sure.
That was the last conversation she had with her sister. Mm-hmm. And if you think she hasn't remembered every word of that conversation. Right. So every conversation should end with an I love you, mm-hmm. with a cherishing, with a blessedness, in my opinion, because life is random. So let me get to number five.
We're not gonna miss number five. I'm on the edge of my seat here.
Number five is...
Wait, let's go. Let's get the edge even edgier. Let's remember from the beginning. So the first one is survive. Survive. You have an obligation in honoring to those who are lost to continue to make it here on this world. Survive. But that's almost an... continuing the minimum. That's the baseline. Do not slide below the baseline. Survive. The second one is embody some aspect. Remember some smile, thought, characteristic trait, something of the lost person, and let that thing live inside your heart. Let that thing be a teacher unto you.
Let it grow. Cultivate it. Nourish it.
And in the same vein, yet differently, do something great in the name of that person. Let that person continue their earthly mission through your hands. Let them be alive by continuing their mission.
And it could be as simple as planting a tree. It could be as simple as putting a sign up in a school that says kindness. It can be something great and simple.
Mm-hmm. Number four is write new chapters of life, not just survive. It's a compendium to number one, where number one is survive. Number four is more than survive.
That's right.
Live, thrive.
Write new chapters of life. Dare to have the courage to write new chapters. This is also your life mm-hmm. to go on. And in so doing that, you honor me. You honor me. Can you imagine me if I watching this and the joy that I will take from seeing you create new life rather than feeling that it was my fault
right.
that you stopped living, that right. you shut it down, that you became the dumbed down version of yourself.
Right. You're causing that person to be a killer. That person was lost, died, something happened. Now you're causing that person's death to also kill you. That person does not want that, would never want that.
So for me, it's Jenna saying, Daddy, let me see the best in you in the time you have. Let me see it bring out the best in you.
Number five. Here we go.
Number five is to develop a spiritual relationship with your loved one. Now, sometimes I will stand before audiences of 10,000 people, and the first thing I say is, yes, I talk to the dead. And I kibitz with them a little bit, and I say, you know what? I'm past the point that I care about whether the thought police are listening. I might be excommunicated from psychology. I might be a delusional and desperate father, grasping for straws, imagining things. I don't care. I bet my faith. I have a choice to either stare into the abyss, into nothingness, and believe nothing, and feel nothing, and to be nothing, or to hold in faith my somethingness, the possibility of a reunion with my daughter, the possibility that when I speak and I say, I love you, Jenna, that in some way she knows it and feels it and receives it, and to receive her I love yous. Now, I bet my faith. Do I know those things are true? No, I don't have certainty. I have faith. I hold those things in faith as sacred, and I nurture them, and I believe in them, and I also open myself to deepen my faith. So if there's something I need to open myself to that will deepen my understanding and faith of how this universe works, I will do that too. You know, just recently in the writing of my new book, I'm on a chapter, I'm finishing the book, and I'm on a chapter that is the most challenging chapter because I'm trying to talk about making peace with life itself, making peace with our own impermanence, with our own mortality. So I'm struggling. I'm reaching into the deepest concepts to understand that we belong to the ages. We belong to the enormity, to what's so much greater than perhaps our capacity to understand it, and to hold in humility our own unknowingness, the magnificence of the mystery of our lives, the parts of it, but also to allow into knowingness and faith and understanding all the things that I'm learning by writing this chapter. It's writing me.
Certainly when you're in the land of Israel and standing in front of the tomb of the fathers and mothers or in front of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, you do sense the enormity of the smallness of us, the enormity of history, of the founders, of the great ones, and also of obviously of bottom line of God, whose great imagination and vision this all is. I think out of your words comes a deep sense of the other world, the beauty of life, that we have to love life. I think in all of this, death and bereavement is a love of life. I think that is the recurring theme here. And at the same time, a humility that we don't have control of it all, and that we have to sometimes let go of things, and we have to let go without letting go of ourselves. We have to keep living. And there's a lot of lessons in it for all of us. And certainly the continuing challenges of the Jewish people and of the human condition in general. and all of us getting older, even, we're all facing the maker at the end, and we're all leaving this world one way or another. So that is a permanence in the world.
And when we live, just adding, I love what you're sharing. And when we live this life of honor, it positions us to truly be of service to our children, our grandchildren, their children, and future generations. And it puts us in a position to be great peacemakers as well. When we've honored the life we're living, we want to find the path to peace. We will have the capacity to look in places that we didn't even know existed and deepen understanding, forge understandings, and forge a peace or the possibility of peace that we never knew was possible.
You know, Dr. Ken, just with regard to that, I think that we have those possibilities in us. I think it's the other side that has yet to think about these things in this way. And it's, you know, our proverbial hand is always extended. Our respect for humans, for their value, intrinsic value, our vision that we see that there's God, a piece of God in every single person, we got that. But there are many people who don't. And there's a lot of, the education has to happen in a lot of other places as well.
So how do we, the question that I always get confronted with is, as I write books, is, as one of my mentors once told me, the only thing that matters is that they want to turn the page. What do we do so that people want to learn from us and are become open to learning from us? How do we conduct ourselves? How do we make ourselves approachable? How do we meet them where they live and in a place that they can understand? I agree with you 100%. We're living in a world that's so disconnected, a world that in which some people are living 5 centuries ago and the rest of the world is advancing at the speed of light. How do we bridge that disconnect? How do we find the bridge? How do we build the bridges? And, you know, I don't pretend to have all the answers, but I know that we need to humble ourselves and stay in the conversation and find strands of truth and connection and persist.
Well, the answer, I think, in part, is that the Jewish state in Israel is in the heart of the world, certainly in a problematic part of the world, but at a crossroads of all of humanity, continues to be the eye of the storm. People are looking to it, and you're absolutely right that Israel, if it strives for that great vision of humanity, can be a light, has to continue to go on its path, and certainly God has put us to be. A spark to the world. So let us hope to continue that mission.
You know, many years ago, as a 19-year-old, I reached out because a war had broken out in Israel, and I was living in New York. I was a college student, and I made several contacts, and I said, I'm ready to come and fight and die in Israel. And as a 67-year-old man sitting before you today, I would be honored to have the privilege to come to Israel and fight and give my life for peace. And I think the journey that I've been on has been largely as a man who's been broken, who's had his heart shattered into a million pieces, and who has become whole again, but who understands something about loss and trauma and peace and how to forge it and how to find a way to the hearts of people who would be our enemies. And I welcome the opportunity to be in that conversation with people who I'm sure are smarter than me about things like this.
Dr. Ken Druck can be found at Ken Druck, just at kendruck.com, on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. Ken Druck, it's very, very simple, K-E-N-D-R-U-C-K. Thank you so much. Thank you for hosting me in your office here in Del Mar, California. And thank you, folks out there, for being with me. I want to hear from you. Write me an email, yeshai@thelandofisrael.com, yeshai@thelandofisrael.com. Write me an email with the subject line, I am a listener. I am a listener or I'm a listener. Both of those are acceptable, but I want to hear from you wherever you are, folks. And I think the lessons that we learned today from Dr. Ken are universal, things that not just grieving of our own, but others. There's always going to be a way to apply this. I know already today where I'm going to apply this today, and I hope that we will live to see a time where we don't have to apply any of this stuff, the great Sabbath, the great day that's going to come one day. But till then, the human experience is such. Ken Druck, thanks so much for letting us in.
Shalom, and thank you so much for this opportunity.
This is Eve Harrow, host of Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. My maternal grandparents, Grandpa Morris and Grandma Lily, came to the United States from Russia over 100 years ago. They belonged to the Mizrahi movement way before there was even a state of Israel. The Land of Israel Network is powered by the Mizrahi World Movement.
Hello, my name is Tommy Waller. I'm the founder and president of HaYovel. More than 12 years ago, I made my first trip to the Land of Israel. What I saw and heard changed my life forever. I stood with Nir Levi, an Orthodox Jewish man, in his vineyard in Samaria on the Mountain of Blessing. There he opened his Bible and read the prophecy of Jeremiah that said, "You shall yet plant vineyards on the mountains of Samaria." This fall, during the grape harvest, we have the opportunity to join Israel as it celebrates the 50th year of the liberation of Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria. Come join us as we witness the unveiling of prophecy in the Jubilee year. Come be a part of the biblical narrative. Go to HaYovel.com, that's HaYovel.com, to find out more. And I hope to see you there.